going to lose?
Both is my understanding. The municipality of Anchorage is between $50 and $70 million. Municipality of, or the North Star Borough in Fairbanks is my understanding between $30 and $40 million, and then the state also loses some funds. This originally I thought was 25% of the federal funds, but it's my understanding now that it's 100% of federal funds. Excuse me, in certain categories.
Senator Ferguson, you can continue.
Yes. I know this legislation is needed, and if those municipalities are handling this situation by ordinance, the people there have to live with it. But I think there needs to be a waiver of some type for those vehicles that are out of bank but registered there.
Senator Howard?
Well, it sounds like DMV will handle that waiver provision. I'm satisfied with that. I had another question. When you say that this legislation is required for the federal law, so the law requires not only that the municipalities affected implement a program, but that, in fact, the state enforce that program through the state registry of vehicles? Is that what the federal law requires?
Madam Chair, basically the federal law requires that the state come up with some type of program in order to reduce the amount of carbon monoxide. They did consider different types of enforcement, such as the sticker program, where somebody gets an inspection, gets a sticker on the car, and if the police see a car driving around without a sticker, they would be cited. The experience in the states down south is about 40% of the people don't comply with that type of program. The only thing that was determined that Alaska could reach the reduction necessary was through the vehicle enforcement, through vehicle registration, in which requires a high percentage of compliance, and therefore would reduce the carbon monoxide.
And that, basically, EPA is going to approve anything that meets that standard, so unless we do this, we can't meet that standard, therefore this is really required indirectly by EPA of the state.
Right, at this point, the program that was approved by EPA did require the enforcement at time of registration.
Senator Ferguson, second.
Can you explain to me how someone that applies contains a false or fraudulent statement? What is a false or fraudulent statement? Could it be a mistake in something that he puts down?
Yeah, it could be in the application where they apply. Of course, they could indicate that there is no lien holder, but there is a lien holder. Or they could indicate that they are the owner of the vehicle, when in actuality they're not. They could indicate an incorrect VIN number or something of that nature.
Okay. If I may, Madam Chair.
Please, sir.
What happens if, say, I live in Kotzebue and I have a vehicle and I transport it to Anchorage? Can I drive on the streets of Anchorage to take the car home or to a place of residence?
If your address on the registration is Kotzebue, then you're not required to pass the inspection program. And this is also true of the people that would drive in to Anchorage from Palmer or Matsubara.
That's all I mean.
Senator Sackett?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to have one of our staff people write up an amendment. One of the lawyers write up an amendment that basically says that waivers shall, put it in the statute, that waivers shall be made for vehicles that may be registered in one of the two municipalities affected, but used or used elsewhere or located elsewhere. Something to that effect. I don't know how to.
I was just thinking that maybe Senator Ferguson could set aside an acre and one-inch plots, issue deed and title to people that wanted to be out for purposes of owning a vehicle.
Is there any other discussion for the department, Senator Hufford?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the only other question I had was on the effective date. The packet includes an implementation schedule. I'd kind of like to know from Anchorage. I'd kind of like to know from Anchorage if they're on schedule. And, you know, everybody after July 1st all of a sudden is going to have this thing. You know, it's been floating around, but this is apt to cause some substantial lines and things like that. Is that the right place to have the effective date in terms of meeting the federal guidelines? Should we, you know, how should we start this thing to get it so it works administratively?
Madam Chair, I would assume let Ken Lawson from Anchorage, who is the program administrator there, answer that. The effective date of the ordinances is July 1 of 1985. therefore would be the same time as the effective date of this bill. And I'm not sure how far along.
I wonder if we could have him come up and you stay and have us, so we can, because that's pretty important.
The program administrator from Anchorage, please. And is the program administrator for Fairbanks here, too? Why don't you come forward also? Jens, can you get him a chair down here? Would you identify yourself, sir, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Lawson, and I am the program administrator for the Municipality of Anchorage's Vehicle Inspection Program.
My name is Lee Husson, and I'm the program administrator for the Vehicle Inspection Program in Fairbanks.
Okay, welcome. You've heard lots of questions here. Senator Halford, would you restate your question?
Well, basically my question to all three of you is, how do we get this thing off the ground and make it work so that we don't end up, when we get back home, with constituents screaming and hollering about lines at either inspection stations or motor vehicle registry? Is July 1 the effective date we have to have? I know we have to have something going by then, but how do we phase into this thing and make it work?
Madam Chair and Senator, both programs have been in design for some time. The municipalities in particular was adopted by the Municipal Assembly in June of 1984. We have been designing the program since that time. Public education, public information is scheduled to begin in a mass media sort of a way on or about June 1st. The certifying of mechanics and garages all over Anchorage and I'm sure Fairbanks has been proceeding on schedule since about January. In answer to one of the earlier questions on the waivers, I believe both the Municipality of Anchorage and the Fairbanks systems are designed to exempt vehicles that are not operating primarily out of Anchorage. And that process is already built into the program, and it's aside from the amendment issue that was discussed earlier.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Ferguson.
How large is the ordinance, in the pages?
Senator, the municipality's ordinance is about 3 pages long, but it includes by reference what we call our design document, which is probably 100 or more pages of details. And it explains procedures by which fleet managers or anyone operating fleets, such as you'd mentioned earlier, operating out of town or someone whose car is used primarily in Juneau, we would be required by that ordinance to provide you with a waiver and exemption from the program.
I just think that are the people in Anchorage or Fairbanks, are they well educated as to the ordinance?
Our major public education effort, again, begins on June 1st. There has been a fair amount of press, some public appearances, and some radio spots, advertising, that sort of thing. But the brochures, the documents that really begin describing the program, will be in the hands of the public on about June 1st. And 1/12 of the community will be notified the 1st of July of the program, basically people whose vehicles are registered in August.
Senator
Humphrey? Well, the schedule here, I don't know whose schedule it is, but it says print and mail July renewal notices in May 1985. Does that mean that everyone, if you run a computer run, everybody has to have registration, re-registration in July, will get notification from the Municipality of Anchorage at least 30 days before they have to re-register their vehicle, that you have to have this inspection and certification of it before you go down and stand in the line at the DMV or send in your registration, however they do it?
That's correct. The timeline is 60 days rather than 90 days, but basically you have the operation correct. The program starts on July 1st, 1985. Now, our definition of starting is that we will start notifying people on July 1st, 1985, that their vehicles are, in fact, included in the inspection program. These people will have until the end of August of 1985 to effect registration. In other words, they will be able to go get their inspection, get their certificate, and turn that into DMV to register their vehicle. We purposely have done this so that we have the first 2 months of the program's inception to bring in the first month's worth of vehicles. We have July and August. The July registrations are not affected. The first month that registrations are affected are August of 1985.
Is that the same in Anchorage?
Correct. And just to clarify, the notice that the public receives will actually be a stuffer, an attachment to the Division of Motor Vehicles registration notice. So the motorist will receive his annual renewal notice and at the same time be notified in some detail of the program.
But the way the legislation reads now, we're giving DMV the authority to design registration starting the 1st of July. For a program, municipalities really don't intend to start until the 1st of August. As long as by regulation, because you have the word May in there, you're not going to deny registration to anyone in the month of July, then I don't have a problem with the July 1st effective date. But I want to make sure that that is the case.
That is our understanding, yes. We will not deny registration on July 2nd because somebody walks in without the inspection.
Okay, both municipalities have exemptions for alternative fuel vehicles and have exemptions for vehicles not based primarily in the municipality. And through your regulation, we may be able to cover a question on where the vehicle is based with a letter of intent, but it's the intent of the legislature that in implementing this, that the department not approve a program which doesn't provide an adequate exemption for vehicles not based on other than the municipality. We may be able to deal with it that way instead of having to go back into legislation.
Well, but a letter of intent has no force of law, and I think we might want to have a legal draft. It's been requested by Senator Howe that we have a legal draft in a paragraph in the CS, and I would support that.
I don't think the House would object to it
either.
Yeah.
Senator Ferguson?
I think it's much better
to
anyway.
In Anchorage and Fairbanks, I presume the vehicle owner
we added this to discussion.
Something for the inspection. What happens with the state?
The only thing charged for the state is the $1 fee to help reimburse the state for the cost of the program.
Okay. How much is it in Anchorage?
The cost of operating the program, administering the program, is designed...
No, not administering the program. What is each vehicle owner going to pay for this service?
Senator, the certificate fee at startup in July is set at $10. There is a charge of $0 to $40 maximum for the inspection itself. The physical inspection will be charged by private garages around town. They will pass on a $10 fee for the certificate, the cost of the municipality administering the program.
This is the one.
Do they pay this directly to the city of Anchorage, or is there a bypass?
It would be paid directly to the mechanic, garage, or dealership where the car is being inspected.
The municipality gets the revenue by selling the blank certificates.
Correct.
How much do they sell the blank certificates?
$10.
Is this a revenue generator or a wash or a loss to the municipality?
Municipalities is designed to be cost-supportive, break-even, and the first year we expect to lose a couple of $100,000. By the second year, 1986, the program should be self-supporting.
What's the total number of vehicles you figure applies to Anchorage?
In Anchorage, we're using, depending on whether you use the vehicles exempt or not, in the neighborhood of 180,000 vehicles. And within that total are perhaps 10,000, 15,000 vehicles that may be exempt from the program for the reasons we've discussed.
So it's 180,000 vehicles, $1.8 million that's going to get charged to people in $10 certificates.
Correct.
Then another $40 too, which would be another $4 million.
Senator Ferguson and Senator Sackett.
It's hard for me to understand how you expect the garage to make any money on this. If what they're going to pay is $10 for the blank certificate.
No, then the garage can charge us anything they
another
want.
Another $40, $50.
$50 for the inspection.
If you get an oil change and a new battery, they may inspect you properly and you won't have
Senator
to
Senator Sackett?
In addition to that, in the fiscal note, the FY86 operating budget request includes an increment of $150,500. Five permanent full-time positions for inspection, maintenance, enforcement. Was that approved by the Senate version and the House version?
I'm not sure. I did not come to the budget hearing.
If it isn't, we better check that out, because that's another additional $150,000 on top of the $48,500.
Oh, wait a minute. That can't be. The municipality does the inspection, not the state.
Well, I'm telling you what it says right here.
The state, the Department of Public Safety, has to decide whether people are
qualified.
They're the enforcement end of this. The municipality is just making us all do all this stuff. The state is having to enforce it.
The municipality is certifying the garages, not the state, isn't it?
That's correct.
So the municipality is handling the inspection. Why has the state got a big fiscal note for inspectors? The inspectors are going to be in the private sector.
Madam Chair, this enforcement for the increment was the five positions. Two of those positions would be in the mail-out program. In which, as a result, for these two areas, which have the large majority of the vehicles for the state, is going to have to handle differently than what we handle all the other mail-out programs. Two of the positions will be to do the insert advising the people that when they come in to register the vehicle or when they mail that back, they're going to have the certification of inspection accompany that and their regular registration fee. The other three positions, one of those is for the Anchorage. One of those is for the Fairbanks field office. Two of them are for the Anchorage field office. Basically, in contacting the other states down south that have this type of a program, it's indicated that as a result of having to process the additional paperwork and explain the system to the people that come in that didn't read the notices before or they're registering the vehicle the first time and so forth, it increased the time that they have to process an application or to put a person through 1 minute, approximately 1 minute per person. At the present time, we process a registration and title. It takes us about 5 minutes. So we're looking at the fact of increasing the time to process applications 20% from the 5 minutes to 6 minutes. The one body in Fairbanks and the two bodies in Anchorage is a 20% increase to what are presently in them two field offices to process, only to process registration and titles, not speaking to the people that process driver's licenses.
So these are clerical people, not inspectors.
All five of them are clerical positions.
Okay.
Plenty of retirement.
Stand corrected. Senator
Sackett. Is it included in the budget that was passed by the Senate? If it isn't, then we need to add a fiscal note here if we agreed to do it for another $150,000. Because this fiscal note is, the premise made is that the increment was approved by the legislature for the FY86. I think Greeny's checking it out right now.
Okay, good. Yes, sir.
Are state and municipal vehicles required to have the certification inspection?
Yes, they are.
I hope that doesn't work for my system.
Senator Ferguson.
One last question. What's the cutoff date that you have for vehicles? 10 years old or 15 years old?
Madam Chair and Committee, in Fairbanks, This is where the programs differ somewhat. In the Fairbanks program, our cutoff date is 1975 models. However, in later years, it will increase to a 15 model year inclusion. In other words, we'll add a model year each year after we get up to 15 years.
And in Anchorage, it starts at 15 years?
Yes. Our program is designed to operate for vehicles 15 years old and newer, with graduated standards for those vehicles. A 1985 vehicle will be asked to meet a much more stringent standard than a 1970 vehicle.
One of the effects of this thing is that people who can afford to have a late model vehicle aren't going to end up having to spend much money. But what happens to the people that can't afford to have a late model vehicle and their vehicle either has a plug catalytic converter or something else, and what's the expense going to be to them? If we're looking at probably $20 to $50 for the inspection fee, but what about the cost of improving the vehicle? I know there's some kind of provisions in it that's so much money, and how's that all work?
Senator, the program is designed to require a level of competence or efficiency from the emission controls based upon the age of the vehicle. A vehicle older than 1970 has essentially no emission controls on it, so they're exempt from the program. Vehicles that are 10 to 15 years old in Anchorage will only receive will not receive an underhood inspection at all. They're simply going to be asked to run a tailpipe test. It's entirely possible that the free market will drive the cost of that particular type of test down even lower than other inspections. Other programs around the country of this type, with similar tests and similar requirements, the free market has typically driven the cost of that test down substantially. In California, very similar test you can find being run for $12.95 on up. And there are several facilities in Anchorage looking at what they're calling a fast lane operation, in which about a 10-minute test will be run, which can be offered much cheaper, and which vehicles that have been maintained for whatever standards is under the hood of that vehicle should be able to pass that test fairly quickly.
If the municipality of Anchorage had adopted a program that only required 10-year inspections, would that have met the federal standards?
We would have had to adjust the stringency or the failure rate on newer cars to compensate for that. There's a computer formula that factors in the age and mix of the vehicle fleet. And by exempting older vehicles, we would be requiring someone with a newer car to do more to their car. A much higher level of efficiency, if you will, and therefore spending more money on their repair bill.
Well, does it in any case require anyone to do anything that wasn't originally done with the car when it was manufactured? And is there any case where there's a legal road license federally approved vehicle that was manufactured, and if these tests will require a modification that was beyond what was originally on that vehicle, then it's moved.
Good point. Good question.
No, there is nothing in the program that would require adding anything to a vehicle that was not originally manufactured on that vehicle.
Are the standards different for pickup trucks and cars? Because the federal standards have been different for pickup trucks and cars, for leaded gas, unleaded gas, catalytic converters, and so forth, in a bunch of those years.
Yes, our standards vary throughout the vehicle, through different vehicle sections, to emulate, not to emulate, but they parallel the manufacturer standards that they've had to meet throughout the year.
So to drive a pickup truck, you'll be able to put out more pollution the same way the federal.
Yes.
Okay, if there are no more questions, what I'd like to do is hold the bill until tomorrow, get a CS prepared with the wavering language, and possibly put some language in there to be sure that they don't require over and beyond the federal standards. I think that was a very good point you made, Senator Halford, that the municipalities can get overzealous with some of these emission standards.
I would have said that.
Yes, you do. Thank you very much. We'll hold this bill until tomorrow. We'll get a CS prepared. We've had people waiting all day on 72. If it's all right with the committee, I would like to go into House Bill 72, at least get started on it today, if we could. What, Elias is passing out an amendment? You've been waiting, you've been holding back on us, Senator.
Elias is bootlegging again.
Okay, in your package, you have a sectional analysis of the bill. It's not that bad reading. Then you have the bill from the Judiciary Committee, and you have a fiscal note that's zero this year, $400,000 next year, based on what new governments and cities they think they're going to have. There is some additional expense for instituting new cities and governments in this bill. And we have lots of people signed up to do this. Jeff, why don't you come up as Acting Commissioner of Community and Regional Affairs? I don't see if the members have any specific questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jeff Smith. I'm the Acting Commissioner of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. I don't have any comments I'd like to make that I haven't already said. However, I'd like to remain up here and react to some of the amendments that are going to be introduced.
Oh.
React.
Okay. We have a series of amendments from Senator Sackett. Then we have an amendment from Senator Eliason. Do we have other amendments? There was an amendment from Multivisions that's proposed. I'm not pushing it, but I'll pass it out.
I lost my Elias and amendment.
Well, I think you should. Would you pass out the Multivisions amendment? Oh, you can give me my little explanation back, because I don't even know what it is. I hope somebody else is going to know more about the Multivisions amendment than I do. Okay. And are there other amendments? What happened to Senator Fisher?
Which is a Multivision, this one here?
The one that says page 34, line 3, proposed amendment to CS, local franchising. Okay, why don't we take up Senator Sackett? But first of all, does anybody need any overview on the bill?
No.
Right then. Let's take up Senator Sackett's amendment first. Senator Sackett, then Senator Elias.
Madam Chairman, I would move for adoption of amendment number 1.
I object just to find it.
Okay. I passed it out yesterday.
Yesterday.
Page 11, line 14.
And this would be for home rule cities if the Bethel desires to go.
Entitled to an order. Yes.
And I look over your shoulder and the
you. Okay. Page 11, line 14.
They were all that. They have them. They just can't find them in their package.
That reclassifies as a first-class city or adopts a home rule charter after December 31st, 1985.
Commissioner, do you have any comments about that amendment?
We do not object to that. We don't oppose that amendment.
You like, okay.
That has a $50,000 fiscal limit, probably.
No.
You don't know if they're going to do it or not.
No. There's already a fiscal note there.
There's already a fiscal.
No, but would that add $50,000 to the fiscal note by including Bethel in the $50,000 grant?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. I don't know.
Because the section is entitled to an organizational grant equal to $50,000.
if they adopt the home rule charter, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. What they've got in the fiscal note is some contingencies if people do some things. So I bet you they have this covered. I think the fiscal note's a little large, but it's there.
Okay. No objection.
The amendment's been moved. Any more discussion?
Is there any other place that can do it?
No.
Check. Okay. Double check. Triple check.
There's no objections. The amendment is adopted. Senator Eliason, the Eliason amendment, please.
Madam Chair, I would move Amendment number two.
Wait.
Was that the number one? I mean, John has, I think it says amendments. That's number one.
I said number
two,
one.
Three.
Yeah. The whole page is number one amendments. It's all for the same thing.
It all does the same thing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's okay, 11, 19.
That's how you.
29.
No,
Senator
Halford didn't do his homework. Father Rick to your office yesterday.
Page 29, after line 9.
Senator Halford, the amendment's been adopted. So as you're studying yours, if you want to have a motion to rescind, but let's go on to Senator Eliason's amendment, the Eliason amendment.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I move amendment number 2, which is dealing with section 20S4.21010C. Ask unanimous consent.
Well, wait. Object to know what it is, seeing that I've just seen this amendment.
Madam Chair, this deals with, in my opinion, which
no more taxes.
It's an issue that was dropped out of the liquor. We restructured liquor bills back in 1980, and this language that I'm proposing to put back in was a part of the bill that passed the Senate 19-1 back in 1980. And inadvertently, in the process, this particular language has dropped out. So, consequently, what has been happening in some of the communities around Alaska, they've, for one reason or another, have instituted sales tax on a specific item. Could be a sales tax, as examples, on clothing only. Could be a sales tax on tobacco only. Could be a sales tax on liquor only. But the problem we've experienced out there is that the state totally regulates liquor. And, just last year or 2 years ago, we've put an increase in taxes on the industry. There's a bill in legislation now which doubles the tax on liquor. So I think that that option should remain with state government. This is it's a very sensitive issue. I think that that there are some communities who they have the opportunity to go wet or to dry. I certainly don't disagree with that. They have the right to regulate the hours of the sale of intoxicating liquors. But I think that when it comes to the taxation that we're giving them the ability to tax under the laws we have in place now to tax a business, a legitimate a business out of business. So I think that it's a discriminatory tax. There are some communities that have imposed this tax, and those communities who have this tax on the books at the present time should be allowed to keep it. But I think looking forward that the state should take control of that particular aspect of the liquor industry.
Senator Halford, then Senator Fisher.
Okay, the way the amendment works is if they elected to tax alcoholic beverages separately before July 1st, 1985, then they can continue to do so.
What we're doing is we're grandfathering those, I think, three or four communities that have it in place now.
What are the communities that have it in place?
No. Jeff?
I know one, Kotzebue.
Kotzebue.
One has it. That's the only one I know.
Craig June and Kotzebue.
Senator Fisher?
I guess the question I have is there are some taxes, such as a bed tax, which we're going to be voting on in our community. Would this prevent a municipality from saying we want to put to the ballot a tax on alcoholic beverages?
No.
Okay. What you're saying is you can't impose a tax on alcohol. It's discriminatory.
Right, right.
We're saying
can the voters?
Hey, just a second. Guys, one at a time. Wait, what's the question? Senator Fisher, did you finish your question?
So I guess it gets back to the question is, can a municipality levy a tax on alcoholic beverages if it's put on the ballot?
At the present time, they can.
Under this language, can they?
Under this language, they can't discriminate between alcohol or food or clothing or any other commodity that's sold in the market. This reasoning being that the state does regulate very stringently the alcoholic program in Alaska. So that's what
the intent of the legislation is to treat them all equally.
Chairperson.
Wait, just a second. Senator Ferguson's first, and then Senator Couture.
I just want to know, Dillingham is thinking about raising the tax on alcohol. And would they be allowed to continue their movement? I guess they wouldn't be able to after July 1, 1985.
As long as their ordinance is fully implemented prior to July 1st, they would be grandfathered in.
Yeah. Any committees are have it in the process, won't be bothered. It's done by July 1.
Senator Fertula?
It brought up an interesting point, and that is that presuming that some items, not only alcohol, were allowed to be taxed in sales tax. For instance, you may, in many areas, do remove pharmaceuticals, prescription drugs. That theoretically places a slightly higher need for taxes on the other items of sales tax. If you removed certain key items that were basic, pharmaceuticals, for instance, will that still allow you to tax alcohol, providing you, say, tax clothing in stores and so on? Or is it no way allowed to tax alcohol if you remove two or three of these real basics, as many areas do?
Commissioner?
Yeah, it's our understanding of the amendment that this refers to tax equalization, and you could not set a sales tax for alcohol higher than any other commodity within the community. Now, it does not affect exemptions for pharmaceuticals or others, as long as if there was a 3% sales tax on alcohol, that 3% sales tax was provided across the board to all items included in your sales tax ordinance.
So what if it's only alcohol and tobacco?
I'm just thinking that.
Excuse me?
Dog leashes and alcohol only.
If it was dog leashes and alcohol only? I don't know what the effects. I'm sure that the liquor industry would probably raise some concerns about that. If
the dog leashes?
If it was that. If your sales tax was that limited.
If in the municipality of Anchorage we have no sales tax, if we decided to tax the liquor industry only, this amendment would prohibit that.
Yes.
Senator Halpern.
But would this amendment prohibit passing a sales tax on alcohol, tobacco, just alcohol and tobacco? Because it says other sales. Does it mean any other sales, all other sales, most other sales?
I think that what you'd be getting into an area is if you limited the number of allowable items under the sales tax to
just... Wait, I've got an idea. Tam Cook, I see you back there. Would you come forward, please? You're the drafter of this amendment. I know. I already told you to go late. I'd like to crank this. Do you think it's impossible to try to get this out? Okay.
For purposes of the record, I'm Tam Cook of Legislative Affairs.
Tam, Senator Halpern, would you direct your question to Tam, please?
Yeah. The way the amendment is drafted, does it say that there can be no sales tax on alcohol if, for example, you have a sales tax that exempts food, pharmaceuticals, rent, and essentials, and then taxes all non-essentials?
I believe that this language probably would not preclude the possibility of taxing alcohol so long as some other item was, in fact, taxed. Sales taxes are structured differently for each municipality. Some municipalities have chosen to exempt, for example, food, or some municipalities choose not to tax, to impose a sales or use tax on room, bed rents, and things like that. The real limiting factor is that a city has to structure its sales tax so that it matches the borough. And so a city would be faced possibly with having to tax those items that the borough taxes. But other than that limitation, there's quite a bit of flexibility in what things, in fact, get taxed. As I read this language, if a municipality, whether it be a city or a borough, in fact imposed a sales tax on anything other than alcohol, it would be free to then also include alcohol within a sales tax structure.
Do sales taxes in all local governments require voter approval? Or is that a matter of charter?
I believe they all require voter approval, and in fact, right now, under existing law, a municipality is only allowed to put a sales tax question on the ballot once a year.
So we're limiting the voters' rights to choose
put a sales tax on by this amendment?
This amendment would limit the voter and the municipality's ability to impose a sales tax only on the sale of alcoholic beverages, if it so chose.
But right now they can't do anything without voter approval as far as imposing a sales tax.
That's right. I think my recollection is that all sales taxes are subject to voter approval.
Is that part of Title 49? I don't believe that.
That's retained within the revision, although I believe the limitation on how many times a municipality may present a sales tax proposal has been liberalized to the voters, so that they're not precluded from presenting a sales tax proposal more than once a year.
Okay, what I'd like to do is, it's after 11. Let's leave this amendment pending for tomorrow. So, Mr. Ferguson, if that's all right, we'll leave it pending. We'll bring this bill up first thing tomorrow morning at 8:30. Senator Ferguson, do you have a comment? Senator Ferguson, do you have a comment?
No.
Okay, the motion is pending. We haven't done anything with it. It's sitting right there, and we'll take up with this amendment tomorrow morning, first bill up, okay? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Meeting adjourned. Thank you all.
I don't believe there has been any problem with sunset provisions, unless there's some problems with the original bill. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, we stand for a reevaluation every 4 years. And, you know, very simply, they'd either put us in or take us out. And the sunset review we've had, the majority of them have gone through without any problems because they've been performing the way we thought they should have performed. The only time you get in a problem is that with those sunset reviews is when the interpretation of what we've done is not exactly what has happened. And unfortunately, this particular bill is a good bill. I don't have any problem at all with it. It's a good bill. I certainly support the concept. But I, for the life of me, I can't understand why these two departments would object to having a review in 1995. A simple repealer is all it takes to repeal that provision in 1995. You don't have to go into redrafting a new bill or anything of that nature. It's not a complicated process. However, it would be complicated if you weren't really doing what we thought you were going to do. That's where the problems come in.
It's a little test to make sure you do what you promised to do.
Madam Chair.
If you do promise to do what you say you're going to do, then there will be no problem.
Madam Chair, it's not a matter of our promising to do something. The legislature is instructing us what to do, and the courts will make sure that occurs. We don't think the courts or the legislature are going to have to look over our shoulder, because this is an area that was requested by the people of the Kenai, and we're prepared to do what the legislation suggests. But I think we need to differentiate between the management plan, which would come before the legislature in 5 years after full public involvement and public hearings before the Board of Game and the department, that's one process. And Senator Eliason, that seems to me to be adequate to provide the kind of review that you're interested in. It's quite a different thing, 10 years from the effective date, to have this area just terminate. This is not a provision for review at the end of 10 years. This is a termination of this area in 10 years.
Senator Lassen.
I guess it's a matter of who wants to give up the hammer.
Listen, we all know that you folks enthusiastically follow the legislature if you like what we say. If you don't like what we say, you are less than enthusiastic in following the law. So this is just a little test. Senator Hopper.
Well, I'll ask the same question I asked Representative Navarre with regard to if the management plan has to come before the legislature. You know, which is a more effective control of the separation of powers? I don't know the answer. Requiring that the management plans be adopted by law, or letting the whole thing go forward so they've got a management plan, they've got it operating, and then once that's operated for 10 years, having it come back for a review, which would probably be a pretty cursory review, it would be existing. There wouldn't be the conflicts with other users unless there were some real problems. I expect it would just zip on through. Which is better? Because I think the legislature wants one or the other.
Madam Chair. I'll ask Ned to join with DNR's views, but in my opinion, the more effective way of ensuring that your intent is carried out is to have the management plan fully discussed and for us to make sure that you know what opportunity the public has had and what the different concerns are that have been accommodated by that plan. To the extent that there can be a dialogue there and appropriate adjustments made, as the planning process proceeds, I don't think we have to wait 5 years to make sure you're informed on how the planning process is developing. But it seems to me that's what is effective rather than having a plan in place and then one, having that plan come before you without previous contact, and secondly, having a sunset at the end of 10 years. The sunset really doesn't... The sunset is really a problem because of what it does to the public and their reliance on this area. As an agency, we deal with legislative matters all the time, so that's less of a problem for us. It seems to me the more effective way is to keep that dialogue going as the planning process proceeds.
Well, dialogue and review are kind of legalese terms that mean nothing. They mean that nobody has any power to do anything but dialogue and review. I'm afraid that too much of this session has been dialogue and review, and I don't think that does anything in terms of the legislative ability to ensure that those plans are followed. But you really didn't answer the question. The question was of the two proposals, approval of the plan by law, and if the management plan is not adopted until it's adopted by law, versus a sunset after 10 years, which do you think... Because with absent either of those, I think the legislature really is giving away its ability to have any influence directly in the management plan other than dialogue and review.
Madam Chair, I think of those two options, it's certainly the first is preferred because the legislature has given some direction both in the bill and in the legislative history of what they want to see in the way of management for this area. So we know what we're supposed to be doing. The second thing that's happened in the bill is that... there's a requirement that Fish and Game consult with DNR, which represents a lot of the competing interests in the area in developing the plan. So I think that probably the plan will have joint work and support from both departments when it eventually comes to the legislature. If the legislature decided it didn't like the plan, probably we would get some indication of what was the matter with it, and we would come back with an improved plan for your review and approval. So I guess clearly that the better mechanism would be to have some sort of a disapproval or, if it's constitutional, an approval mechanism in the bill rather than a sunset clause.
Senator Ferguson.
To keep this piece of legislation moving, I'd move that we delete Section 3,
It's been moved that we delete Section 3. Senator Hopper, discussion?
Madam Chair, I would object unless the motion could be amended to provide that we delete Section 3 and add under D in Section 2 that the management plan shall be completed by July 1st, 1989 by the Department in consultation, Fish and Game in consultation with resources, and the management plan shall be submitted to the legislature for, and change the word review to approval.
I'm going to object to the amendment. Senator Ferguson?
I'd rather divide the questions.
Okay, the motion has been made to delete Section 3. It's Senator Elias,
Madam
we
Chair,
are under discussion.
Under discussion, this particular bill was reviewed in detail in the Resources Committee, and as a member of that committee, I would object to the deletion.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor of deleting Section 3, raise your hand. All those opposed? Section 3 is deleted. Further discussion? Motion passes. Senator Hopper? Well, I don't like the bill now. Senator Fisher.
Chair, yes, the teleconference. As I said earlier, I think that was the one item that the people were most concerned about. The party, there were two people that were totally opposed to the bill, and maybe we can put their argument to rest if I can address a question to the chair, to Mr. Council.
Sure, Senator.
There seems to be at the teleconference only two people opposed to the bill in total. But I think it's a good bill, and I think the majority of the people, I think it's a good bill. Their concern was their existing... they have existing grazing leases now. And their concern was that, is there anything to prevent Fish and Game from coming and saying, you can't put that fence up even though you thought you were going to do it 5 years ago. You can't raise this kind of crop because we feel it might adversely affect the moose somehow, even though 5 years ago you wanted to do this. This is part of your individual grazing plan. And if the grazing plan is in existence now, stays and they can do all those kinds of things, then maybe they would even agree, then therefore you'd have unanimous
I don't know. Maybe they have concerns. How do you see
it? Senator, I think the existing grazing leases continue in effect just as they are. If the leases allow for different kinds of plantings and fencing, those leases would continue and not be modified as a result of this. I think the grandfather clauses are clear enough in that respect. So I can understand that concern that their ability to conduct their operations be respected. I think that's exactly what we've tried to do with working with DNR and developing the valid existing rights language.
Madam Chair, I would just concur. The Department of Fish and Game, I think, intends to allow this kind of continued grazing operations, and I don't think there's going to be any interference with continuation of existing uses.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, that's their concern, and you know, if that's taken care of, then I think you have really pretty wide support, because they were the only two, and I believe they were husband and wife, that have, I guess, extensive grazing leases within the area, and that was their concern, that they'd be shut down. So I'll give them a call today and let them know that they will be able to continue the way they had planned to continue anyhow. Okay.
All right, if there's no more discussion for today, we'll hold this bill till tomorrow so the Resources Committee's objections can be worked out. We're going to take a 5-minute break now. Please come back at 4:15. Yeah, here, you guys. I'm messing up. There is a baby. Let's call the meeting back to order, please.
We got a cultural amendment.
Call the meeting back to order, please.
So we don't get into problems like management plans.
House Bill 335. This is the Senate CS for House Bill 335 Finance. Mr. Urien? We have not moved the Finance CS. This is supposed to be the creative document that has reached the big compromise between the midwives and the doctors. Senator, second.
I would move the Finance CS for 5385 with a PM.
It's been moved that we adopt the Finance CS with 5385 as the citation up at the top. Any objections? Okay, the Finance CS is before you. There is an exclusion from regulation on page 5, which I believe takes care of the grandfathering in the midwives out in, well, everywhere, rural Alaska, that do this as a part of the community service. Mr. Urien?
On behalf of the State Medical Association, the Midwives Association, and most of those who sent you POMs, we would ask that you pass the bill out of committee.
Are you speaking for the Midwives Association
yes.
today?
Yes.
Do they know you're speaking for them today?
Yes.
Oh, here's one.
Here's a midwife. Yeah, I told you, gentlemen.
Okay. We give them up.
Would you identify yourself, ma'am, please?
My name is Kay Connie. I'm a midwife, and I'm with the Midwives Association.
And you Thank all you. Adopt this seal. Okay. Is there any discussion? The bill has been moved out with individual recommendations. Any objections? So moved. Thank you all very much. Okay. Let's do.
Weapon that she delivered
I don't know if she delivered. I don't know what's happening here. Let's go back up to House Bill 103, and then we can get rid of Mr. Tillinghast. Let's see. House Bill 103. House Bill 103 also has a zero fiscal note. This bill addresses emergency sales for the disposal of royalty oil and gas. Currently, right now, if there is an emergency sale for royalty oil or gas and someone bids and is the successful bidder, then they are prohibited from bidding again if the sale is immediate. Mr. Tillinghast can come forward and speak to this bill, and we also have Kay Brown from the Division of Oil and Gas to speak to this bill. Mr. Tillinghast?
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is John Tillinghast. I'm here representing Texaco. Texaco has been an active participant in the Department of Natural Resources competitive oil and gas sale program. The department held a major competitive sale last November and earned approximately $20 million, $18 million over the in-value price. If the market conditions hold, if the reasons why the $18 million were received last year hold true next year, DNR would like to consider another competitive sale. The trouble is there's a current legal impediment that raises an issue which the AG's office thinks is serious regarding the department's ability to hold that second sale. And that's the renewal prohibition that you see in Section 2 of the bill. When the legislature allowed DNR to hold one-year sales without legislative approval back in the 1970s, they put a rider on there that said that you can hold one-year sales without legislative approval, but you can't continue or renew a contract with the same party without getting legislative approval. The intent was obvious. The intent was simply to prevent a short-term negotiated competitive sale from turning into a long-term negotiated sale by having seriatim renewals of the same contract. It was never intended to prevent the department from letting, say, Texaco bid in 1985 on a new sale simply because it had obtained oil in 1984 under a separate sale. You always call bills technical when you want them to pass. This one is technical. It doesn't express a preference for competitive sales over other kinds of dispositions. It simply removes a legal barrier to a subsequent competitive sale this year. It's a bill that respectfully submit has to be passed this year if there's going to be a competitive sale. It passed the House by a wide margin, has generated very little controversy on behalf of Texaco. I would urge the committee to pass out the bill in the form that it now appears.
Mr. Tillinghast, your primary problem is you allowed this bill out of the House with a broad title.
It used to be worse, Madam Chair. We thought we fixed it. Every last couple of days, maybe we didn't.
All right, are there any questions for Mr. Tillinghast? Mr. Tillinghast, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Kay Brown, Division of Oil and Gas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Tillinghast has accurately and described the intent and purpose of the bill, and I don't have anything to add to his remarks on the bill. If we are, in fact, going to entertain amendments on the gas issue, which is unrelated, I would like to speak to that briefly.
Senator Fisher, what would you like to do?
Yes, Madam Chair, what I would like to do is at least adopt the proposed amendment that's being circulated now. And are we using the House Bill 103 is before us, right? Okay, and if the committee would review the proposed amendment, do you want me to talk on the amendment now?
Well, I think you should if you are asking the committee to adopt the amendment.
May I ask a question before he speaks to it?
On generally the bill, just
on these two amendments.
All right, Senator Petula.
Is this proposed amendment the amendment that the administration's director is proposing?
No, Senator.
I haven't read it. That's the reason I asked.
Senator Fisher.
Madam Chair, this proposed amendment, right now coal is covered, but royalty natural gas is not. And if you look at the amendment, it would allow that the benefit would be that we would allow the price of natural gas to be less than the market value, which would mean that the South Central utility users would get that break. The governor maintains now, or the department did come in and say, unless we do this, they're going to have to charge market value for our natural gas, thereby causing the utility bills of the folks from South Central to rise considerably. This is taken from Senate Bill 276, which myself and Senator Kelly co-sponsored. This is actually the whole Senate Bill 276, which had that only as its purpose, to add natural gas to a provision which now includes coal. Madam Chair, I would this time...
Wait, why don't you, before you make a motion, why don't we get some more discussion? Okay, Senator Elias.
Where's Senate Bill 126?
Senate Bill 276.
Pulling
the
bill.
We're going
to pull a bill of this amendment.
It is tantamount to pulling a bill out of committee.
Bill.
What is the status of the bill in the Resources Committee?
You know?
I don't know. I'm not the chairman.
Too late to pull a bill, I think, unless you discuss it with the Resources Chairman.
I think
into a battle we don't need.
Yeah, why don't that? That's true. That is true.
Well, why don't we ask the chairman?
Why don't we put this amendment aside right now? And Senator Fisher, why don't you go?
Sure.
We'll just keep that aside, and then we'll touch base with the chairman and make sure there's no problem.
You want to do it now? Go ask her.
Okay.
Can we take a 2-minute break? Or
Senator Halford?
Or could we hear this other amendment that was...
Yes.
All right. There's another amendment proposed.
Yes, and I'm not certain. I don't believe Senator Sagan has received...
I don't have a copy of it either.
Madam Chair, briefly some background for you. As you're probably aware, the department has recently made an action to enforce the oil and gas leases. We believe that the leases entitle us to get the value, the current value of the gas. The contract price is one of three things that is to be looked at in setting the floor on value. Our action in this regard has the effect of causing a small increase to consumer rates in Anchorage, and this has generated quite a lot of controversy. At the request of a number of members of the legislature, we have been working to try to find a solution that would keep the prices down. Now, the solution put forth in the proposed amendment by Senator Fisher goes to in-kind taking. You know, under the lease, we can take in-kind or in-value, and it is the in-value that is the controversy. This would authorize us to take in-kind. However, there are a number of practical problems with taking in-kind. It's not a certainty that the passage of this bill would allow a quick solution. In fact, it probably would not, because Chugach, in their contract of Beluga, has a most favored nation clause, which means they cannot buy from anyone else at a higher price without endangering their low-cost contracts. So one idea that was put forth by one of the Beluga producers was, had the state considered an underlift or banking its share, leaving it in the ground and getting it out later, when perhaps the market would be better or when the local contracts would have run out, and if it were the legislature's desire to sell at a subsidy, you would have more gas to make an impact on the situation. The royalty is really only 5% of the total gas usage. So I looked at this, and the more we began to look at it and discuss it with people, it did seem that it held promise as an approach we should consider. It has had the concept, which is in the proposed amendment to 180L, had a hearing in the House yesterday at which this language was discussed, and I believe that the change being proposed here, right now it says you must get, if you do one of these trades, which is already authorized by statute, and it is discretionary, it would not be imposed on the lessee. It would have to be a free agreement of all the parties. We'd have to get it back in the first half of the field life or in 15 years, whichever is sooner. Now, at Beluga, that field has been in production since 1968. Only 19% of the total reserves have been produced to date. So we feel that even though we're more than 15 years into the life of that field, there's still plenty of time to recover the state share without danger of not getting the state share back.
Ms. Brown, who's liable if the field runs dry before the state gets its share?
That issue would be covered in any agreement that we might negotiate, and I think what we would envision would be a backup agreement that said if by some chance that field couldn't produce it, that we would be entitled to get it from another field owned by the same producer. So
you are making the producers have the brunt of this legislation. In other words, the field goes dry, it's their fault, not yours, for not taking the in-kind when you should have and waited to the end. In other words, who's responsible for knowing exactly when that field's going to run dry or not? Is it the state gambling?
Madam Chair, we would envision a fixed-term agreement that coincided with the end of the Chugach contract. And it would say no later than 1990, 1992, the state will begin again taking it back, and plus an extra increment that would pay us back. So that would be worked out by our engineers and by the engineers of the oil companies. And we certainly would approach that issue with a great deal of caution to ensure that the state was not left on the short end.
Senator Hopper.
Well, the existing law and this amendment provide with the consent of the lessee. Now, I would assume the lessee is not going to allow or want an underlift unless their share can come back from there as well, unless the lessee actually would rather take it off a different field. I can't see where we're doing anything. If Beluga is only 19% produced after 16 years, and they wanted to extend for 5 more years, they might get up to 25%. But the owners and the state would have to agree that it's okay to do that. And all we're doing is giving them the authority to go negotiate and see if they agree. Why are we hurting anybody?
It just gives us a tool to try to work this problem from another angle. And I think that it would be in the state's interest under the circumstances. There's no good market for that gas at the present time. The present needs are met by the existing contracts. The foreign market is not sufficiently developed, and we would envision, you know, like giving that we could get back to either in kind or in value on a certain period of notice, so we would not be locked in for an indefinite period.
Senator Ferguson.
Does the proposed amendment by Paul Fisher have any effect on the North Slope?
The way this amendment reads now, yes, it would affect statewide any gas. And as I believe Senator Ferguson is aware, we have had a request to begin discussions with the North Slope Rural Utility about a gas sale to them. So this amendment would affect or could affect the price at which any gas sale were made. And it coupled with the amendment I'm proposing, what you would be setting the groundwork for would be a sale back to utility, or let's take the Anchorage situation, a sale back to them in the early 90s at less than market value. You know, because don't forget what's going to happen when those contracts run out is they're going to be renegotiated by the producers to a market price, and that is when the real impact on the consumer is going to be felt, because there is going to be a big jolt when those contracts run out. And by banking some extra gas along the way, you would have a little bit more ability to make an impact on that situation in the 1990s.
Further discussion? Senator Fisher.
Madam Chair, at this time, I'd like to withhold my proposed
Senator
amendment.
Senator Fisher is withdrawing his amendment to this bill. Senator Hoffman.
Just to bring it before us for consideration, I would move the Division of Oil and Gas Amendment. I can't see where it could possibly do us any harm.
I object. It's been moved that the Oil and Gas Amendment is before us. Further discussion?
Question. I have a question, right. Chairperson.
Okay. Senator Ferguson first, then Senator Petula.
Is this amendment needed with the original bill?
The amendment is not needed to accomplish the original bill. The amendment is needed to let us pursue a resolution of the Anchorage gas situation along the line I described with a future trade. Without that, we would just not have that ability to pursue that line of negotiation.
Okay, you created the problem in Anchorage.
Well, respectfully, Senator, we feel it is our obligation to enforce those leases.
You interpreted the law the way you wanted to. Senator Halford.
Well, regardless of how we got here, protection in the amendment saying with the consent of the lessee, I don't know that anyone in the industry can get hurt, and there's a potential for a benefit to the consumers in the Anchorage area, which may or may not be realized, but if it isn't, we haven't lost anything. That's why I thought the amendment was appropriate. It doesn't do anything that isn't agreed to by all parties. And it doesn't change existing law, except that you've got one field that's only got seven, you know, the field that's important is longer than 15 years, so the existing law that would have applied several years ago doesn't apply now, but there's still only 17 or whatever the percentage is used.
Senator Petula.
A question to the chairperson. Are your concerns partly, and I'm not speaking to the present director and decision makers, are your concerns partly that we could open it up to where we fumbled and bumbled and screwed up and eventually didn't protect the way the director now states there will be a protection of concern and administratively with their propensity to screw up, that's where we would somehow end up in some reserve with no recourse and no gas either?
Yeah, what the bill is saying is that they can wait and take the royalty at the end of the field. Who's going to determine what the end of the field is? I mean, who is responsible for the judgment of when you know the field is over? And who's responsible? You say that there's only 19% of the reserves recovered. What if there's an earthquake under there or something, and that gas seeps out or goes whatever? You don't know for sure. That 19% is an estimate, and it's a best guess estimate at best. I know it's based on some fairly solid mathematical formulas, but it's still an estimate. And I think what you're doing is you're laying the responsibility of determining the exact moment when that recovery of that field is going to be over and when the state can recover its royalty. I think you're putting a lot of questions out there.
Well, possibly, if you look at this thing, and I think you may be right in part, just because the 15 years is the provision that's getting us in trouble. Not the first half of the field.
Right.
And it may be appropriate to delete the 15 years, but not to delete the first half of the field. That would still handle the beluga problem and not open the door so that that has to be so far wrong. And that's the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in combination with the industry's data and everybody else that gets those numbers. So maybe it would achieve the purposes proposed if we simply left the existing language and changed and deleted the or no later than 15 years after the start of production. So that it would read that on the condition that the state receives back its stored or traded royalty share during the first half of the estimated field life.
I think that's a good compromise. That's reasonable security.
I understand.
Because the language they're adding is maybe a little bit broad. But the 15-year thing, in Beluga's case, if the numbers are anywhere near right, they're nowhere near half used. If you just don't want to address it, that's fine.
I'll go with what the committee wants to do, sir. Ferguson? I hate to kill this bill, though, with an amendment that we don't know how the House is going to feel on it, but Senator Ferguson?
I'd feel a little bit better if this was brought up in resources.
I would draw the amendment if nobody wants to.
No. Is there anybody in favor of this amendment?
Well, yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
In addition to your problems, the amendment is incorrectly worded. That's not what the subsection I reads to begin with.
Excuse me, sir, that's an L.
Or L. J-K-L, rather. That's not what it reads. Some things need to be underlined. Some further things need to be underlined.
Well, see, I would like...
In addition to that, I'd like to also get some revenue or something, some fiscal impact. Feeling as to what loss of revenue the state was having.
Yes, sir. We were asked to look at that question, and in FY86, the undisputed amounts that if you were to enter into an arrangement like this at both the Kenai Field and the Beluga Field to accommodate those situations, you're looking at $1.5 million that would not be taken in FY86. That's a rough estimate of the impact.
If you made the agreement.
If you were to make the agreement at both of those fields.
And that benefit would flow to Chugach?
That benefit would flow to the state of Alaska at some point in the future when the gas was recovered.
But it wouldn't require the action currently, which is going to increase Chugach's gas.
That's right. It would leave the customer prices in acreage getting the full benefit of the 21-cent contracts. Okay.
Senator Sackett.
What was the dollar amount again? I'm sorry.
$1.5
million. Okay, the present language reads, and correct me if I'm wrong, subject to provisions of AS-3105, the commissioner has discretion to enter into an agreement whereby, with the consent of the lessee, the state royalty share of oil and gas production. That's not what this says.
Yeah. We followed you along perfectly so far.
Oh, I must have the wrong one. Subject to provisions of AS-005.
Yes.
Dash 3105, 170?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a change. That's a change from the existing language.
Oh, the 170 is a change, you're saying. Oh.
And the commissioner may, this is the commissioner has discretion, at his discretion, and to receive the, they haven't underlined all of the correct words.
Oh, we haven't underlined all the changes.
Yeah.
On the amendment, the part not underlined is existing statute. The part in all caps is proposed to take out. The underline is proposed to add in. But what he's saying is it's not existing statute.
That's not the way the existing statute reads. There's something I don't know.
Might be a supplement.
Could be.
Check the supplement.
What's the problem with bringing these in?
Minutes before the committee. I don't like to do that because it puts us all in a funny position. Senator Halpert, would you withdraw your amendment, please?
Okay,
the amendment's withdrawn. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Senator Fatula?
If we can get to the bottom of the concern of the amendment, I may try to place it in on the floor. I don't know that I will, but I just want to mention to the committee.
I have some proposed wording for you if you want to.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on House Bill 103? Thank you.
Thank you.
What's the pleasure of the committee on 103? Senator Ferguson?
Madam Chairman, I'd move that we move committee substitute for House Bill number 103, Finance for the Individual Recommendation.
Any objections? So moved. Thank you. Okay, 81, House Bill 81. This is one of those bills I think I hate, but we have to have. House Bill 81 is an act relating to motor vehicle emission inspections. Apparently, we have two towns in the state that are dirty, have dirty air, Anchorage and Fairbanks. And the feds say we have to clean up our air or we're going to lose federal funds. And this bill that currently the Department of Motor Vehicles may refuse to register a vehicle if the vehicle is mechanically unsafe or stolen. And there's a laundry list of things that the department can refuse to register a vehicle for. This bill would add that the vehicle could be refused registration if it does not meet the state-approved local emissions inspections of program adopted by municipal ordinance. So it's adding the laundry list of emissions, good emissions, onto that list of the Department of Motor Vehicle can refuse the registration. Senator Ferguson.
Have you looked at the ordinance for Anchorage?
No, sir.
Well, it seems to me that they're taxing some people by the amount, and correct me if anyone knows the amount, as I very well could be, by $10 per permit, or for...
The license?
No. What I understand is the city will give the garages in Anchorage some forms, and they'll sell them to people for $10 a piece. And I don't know if somebody...
Okay, Mr. Dennerline's here, and we have representatives from the municipality of Anchorage. Maybe they could answer those things for us. We've also got the Department of Public Safety here, too, Bill Brown. So if we have any department questions, why don't we take the Department of Public Safety first, Mr. Brown?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bill Brown, Division of Motor Vehicles, Department of Public Safety. Basically, we'll attempt to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Any questions for the Department of Public Safety on the submissions? Can you do this without any hassle?
Big bureaucracy, lots of money.
I wouldn't say we could do it without any hassle. Basically, we had an increment in the operating budget, which would fund the additional positions we're asking for in order to handle this additional program. Also, the bill does allow us to collect $1 per vehicle that's
so
subject to this inspection,
generated.
And the revenue is sufficient to pay for the additional cost of the program.
The fiscal note of 419.85 then showing revenue of $200,000 and total operating of 48.5 is accurate in the most recent?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That 48,000 was added on as a result of an amendment made in Senate State Affairs. The additional expense is in increment in the operating budget. The 48,000 is as a result of the Senate State Affairs amending the bill, where we would have to make a determination as to the type of fuel that the vehicle is being used to operate by, and if it's something that does not emit carbon monoxide, therefore we would exempt it from having to have the inspections. Originally, it was set up that the municipality of Anchorage and the North Star Borough in Fairbanks are the ones that would determine whether or not the vehicle was exempt from the inspection programs.
Questions? Senator Halpern.
How does the system work with vehicles that are registered to residents of Anchorage but are not based in Anchorage?
Madam Chair, basically the way it's set up is by the address of the owner of the vehicle. And at this time, if the address is in Anchorage, then they are subject to the inspection. And possibly somebody from Anchorage, the program manager, is here. Maybe they should be the ones that would answer that. There may be a way that would exempt somebody that is in the military, still has an Anchorage address, and is serving in Florida.
With regard to the language of the bill, it says the department may refuse to register a vehicle if the department is not required to refuse, and also provides that the vehicle is subject to a state-approved local emission inspection program. Are the Anchorage and Fairbanks programs currently state-approved?
Yes, they were approved by the State Environmental Conservation.
That's who approves them, the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Yes.
Is there any way that the department needs to be able to still refuse to make it seems the discretion is with the department. In this area, even though the department has approved the plan, they can still issue the license, because it doesn't say they shall refuse. They can issue it regardless of whether the emission inspection has been complied with or not, at their discretion, it looks like.
Madam Chair, that is correct. Basically, it is our policy. It has been set up that we would not register a vehicle. The May would allow for them type of instances where the person, again, has an anchorage address by residing in Florida.
So the state will make that determination, not the municipality, then?
Well, I just haven't been that familiar with the original workings of it to know whether or not that type of exemption has been allowed.
Senator Ferguson?
There are many vehicles that are registered in Anchorage to private firms that deal all over the state. And what would happen in the case of a vehicle moved to, say, Fairbanks or moved to the North Slope?
Basically, if the owner's address is still Anchorage, then that vehicle is subject to the inspection. And, of course, Fairbanks is also included, so that wouldn't be the problem, but the North Slope would be the problem. Something would probably have to come up with a waiver if there's no way that vehicle can reach a location where it can be inspected.
Senator Hopper?
Well, is there... I mean, even if the vehicle can reach a location where it can be inspected, if it doesn't operate there, there's no reason to inspect it, is there?
Again, I am not... That has not been brought up before, and I'm just not familiar with how an exemption would be made.
Take the legislator's car. Now, I happen to have a car here. It's registered in Anchorage. I mean, its home base is in Anchorage, but it hasn't been in Anchorage for 3 years now. It sits down here. So, does that mean that I'm going to have to somehow get that car up to Anchorage and have it inspected and bring it back down to Juneau because it's my Juneau vehicle? I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I definitely know what you're addressing. I definitely know there are problems, which, again, not being completely familiar with the program, I have not been working on. I feel there would have to be a waiver for that type of situation. There would absolutely be no reason why you would have to drive to Anchorage to have an inspection and drive back down here. You would have your Juneau address as far as the legislative address and register at that location.
Same person?
There are many contractors in Anchorage that fly their vehicles all over rural areas of the state and not necessarily being kept in Anchorage. And it'd be quite a burden to fly them back and get them registered or go through the procedures and then take them back out there.
I would definitely agree that there would have to be some exceptions to that type of situation.
Senator Hopper?
Will those exceptions be handled by the state or by the municipality? Will the state implement a program so that the individual, because they're dealing with the state, and they may not even have access at the time they want to register the vehicle to the municipality. Someone who's down here, and the registration comes up in March, and goes out here to get a registration, their address is still Anchorage, the vehicle is still here. Will there be some kind of a certification that the vehicle is based somewhere else, and the DMV will go ahead and register the vehicle, or do they have to go through Anchorage to get the approval to register the vehicle?
I would say that the final responsibility will be the state's, and therefore the state is the one that would have to make the exemptions, probably with the approval of the municipalities.
The state will be handling the exemption process?
Yes.
Senator Sack.
What do you mean, with the approval of the municipality, that they would have to agree with the state's exemptions? Before they could be effective?
I would say that it would be discussed with them. If there's these type of situations which have been brought up, that just common sense indicates that there has to be some exemptions. The state would have to agree to, would have to make the exemption, but generally would discuss that with the municipalities.
Senator Petula, then Senator Ferguson, then Senator Halpert.
I have a history of substantial support for the Department of Public Safety, but every now and then, the letter of the law comes about. Now, in the Runaway Children's Act, the department got very rigid on the letter of the law. And I'm not so sure that we hadn't better be very careful in legislation that gives you some person that doesn't recognize the spirit of the law in the field too much authority in this regard. We better solve it here.
I'm not sure if this was discussed earlier. Again, I have not been involved in any of the discussions with the municipalities, and the program administrators for both Anchorage and Fairbanks are here today, and possibly it has been brought up before. They've been working with the director and the deputy director of motor vehicles in Anchorage.
Senator Ferguson?
I understand that we have to pass this bill in order to meet federal standards by APA. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Or else